You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Just after World War II, it seemed that something had started to be noticed in the skies all across the world. And after 1947, we officially entered the age of the UFO. Over the next 20 years, thousands of people across the world claimed to see strange lights and craft in the skies. People began to claim they were communicating with our space brothers. Strange creatures were encountered from nation to nation. In his new book, The UFO Investigators, Charles Lear takes us back to those heady post-war era days as a cavalcade of characters, contactees, scientists, military personnel, and UFO groups all appear to investigate the phenomena. From claims of alien metals and conspiracies, to the birth of the Philadelphia experiment, hucksters and fraudsters, and allegations of it all being a communist plot. Nothing, it seemed, was too alien to be investigated. And yet, they seem quite reasonable when we consider that we will also cover dog-friendly aliens, giant robots, and one of my very favourite UFO stories that involves pancakes from outer space. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Let us look to the skies as we hope to encounter some friendly alien visitors with my guest, Charles Lear. On today's episode, I'm delighted to welcome researcher and author Charles Lear. Charles's new book, The Flying Saucer Investigators, dives into the golden era of post-war UFO mania and some of the amazing characters and cases that it produced. From the influence of magazines, popular culture, and conspiracies, the book is a fascinating read, regardless of your belief in the history of flying saucers. Charles, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hey, thank you, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well. Yourself?
I'm just lovely over here in Queens, New York.
Yes, I was going to ask you, it seems very sunny still there on the East Coast.
Oh, we've got rain today. Actually, I looked it up. Do you know that it rains more in New York City than it does in London?
To be fair, we're in the middle of a drought here, so London's had, I think in July, it's had 1% of its normal July rainfall.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's hosepipe bans galore here. We've had heat wave and torrential downpour and heat waves, so it's crazy here. But yeah, that's one of those strange things that people forget, that difference of latitude that often people just perceive we're quite similar and yet quite different, really.
Yeah.
Your book, Charles, is a wonderful collection of historical documents, outlandish characters, crazy conspiracies. What on earth is the driving force that's pulled you, a man with such a long history in theatre, into this madcap world of the post-war UFO era?
Well, I've always had an interest in pretty much all things paranormal from a very young age, as long as I can remember. And I really got into UFOs heavily in the 80s and 90s, and especially when I could get videotape documentaries. So I had a store that had a video store that had like copious amount of them. So I watched, all of them. And then, of course, when the internet came along and you could watch documentaries there, I watched them there as well. Read a lot of books, and then I got to the point where I got past what I'll call 101. You know, you can't hear "Are We Alone?" You know, so many times you can bloody hear that, right?
Yes,
and hear all the you know, Kenneth Arnold, 1947. It's just, so I wanted to get deeper into it, and I started writing a blog for Martin Willis over at Podcast UFO.
Yeah,
and so as I'm writing, you know, I found my voice and found the way I like to approach the subject. And that was as an historian. That way, you know, I don't have to, I can keep my opinion out of it and just present the facts as documented. And as I was writing it, I put out one every week. So I basically usually pick, some case or other. And so I'm interested in the Flatwoods case, for instance. So I start digging into it. And then I find that, well, there are three versions of what happened to the dogs. Okay, let me find out what the hell happened to the dog here. So in order to do that, you need to go back to original sources. So the original newspaper accounts, oftentimes the first people the witness will talk to are reporters. So you get an account as close to the event as possible. And then if an investigator gets on the scene quickly enough, then you'll get those. If they're transcribed, all the better. If the investigator has left a file, even better.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I'm writing for Martin, I got to know where all these files are. And they're all over the internet now. There are various research organizations that site Saturday Night Euphoria. There's a Northern Ontario UFO Research Society. These people have digitized magazines, documents, and periodicals of the investigation organizations. There's the Archives for the Unexplained in Sweden. There's archive.org. And QFOS, Center for UFO Studies, J. Allen Hynek's group. And National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was headed up by Donald E. Kehoe. They both still have active websites, fairly active. They're rather old looking, but they're still up there. And you can find all the NICAP publications. You can, the UFO Investigator, and you can find original QFOS files. So in any case, I got to learn where all these things were. So as to how that's how I got into looking at it as an historian. To answer your question, Martin, after writing for him for about 3 years, Martin said, you know, you have enough material that you could put together a book. You should. He was friends with Philip Mantle.
Mm.
He got Philip Mantle in touch with Calvin Parker. And Calvin Parker wrote a book and Philip published it. And the book did quite well. So Philip was thankful to Martin. So Martin said, well, look, I have the guy who writes my blog is interested in doing a book. You know, will you talk to him? So he said, sure. So I had the idea to write about the flying saucer investigators, mainly after reading John Keel's The Mothman Prophecies. There are all these interesting characters in there. There's Gray Barker, Ivan T. Sanderson, Jim Moseley. They all seem really interesting. I wonder who these people are. I'd like to find out more about them. You know, this was well before I pitched the idea to Philip, but I did write a couple of blogs about some of these guys, and I said, the investigators are fascinating. So it'd be really cool to write a book, mainly looking at it from their point of view. So I pitched the idea to Philip, and he went for it, and the result is The Flying Saucer Investigators.
Well, I think it's one of those books that is long overdue, because I think often in this modern era, people look back at this period, Charles, with some degree of skepticism, or they just don't seem to consider much of it to be dealt with in a serious way. But when you really dive into it, as you've done, and look at some of these characters and the organizations that were all bought after Kenneth Arnold hit the headlines in 1947, as you refer to there, every historical UFO documentary worth its salt seems to have started at that point, especially in the 90s. So it's nice that we've kind of had the opportunity for you to go into this history and revisit some of these characters that seem to have dropped off modern reference, or even people's understanding of how important some of these people were, and the fact that it seemed that there were so many interesting characters of varying levels of honesty, shall we say, that
yeah.
I think one of the interesting things I found about some of the early reports into some sort of from the 1940s into the 50s is that there are so many key ingredients that we presume are involved in a lot of UFO cases that it's really strange to see that the germination of some of these ideas, like men in black, conspiracies, people being bumped off, people being shut down because they knew the truth, are all born in sort of this era. And yet here we are, 75 years later from the modern UFO era beginning, and they're still with us in a lot of cases. Were you surprised as someone with an interest to see how far back some of these cliches that we embrace in modern ufology sort of had their germination in this period?
Yeah, I wouldn't say surprised. I sort of knew, but it was just really reinforced like right from the very beginning that all this stuff was there. And the Maury Island incident, you know, you have a man in black, you have a plane crash, a newspaper report of a plane crash with two Army Air Force officers of special intelligence dying because they had a box full of material reported to be from a UFO. That, you know, this was the Maury Island. In any case, yeah, right from the get-go, and very, very early on, we're talking the Maury Island incident. I think it's investigated in 47 or 48. Right from the get-go, you like this kind of stuff.
It's also very interesting at that sort of early period when everybody's beginning to sort of take notice and start looking to the skies, that two of the most ingrained magazines of the era are obviously Amazing Stories and Fate, and both seem to be, for better or worse, promoters of this theory, because obviously Amazing Stories had uncovered the gentleman Richard Chaver, who is more than larger than life, I would suspect, and his whole concepts of rediscovering lost languages and Lemuria and moving that forwards, and obviously their connection with Kenneth Arnold at that post-war period and sort of trying to work with him, but also Arnold working alongside Fate, which also started at that period, whereas Stories had obviously been running through the war period.
Yeah, it's really interesting that John Keeld called Ray Palmer, publisher of Fate magazine, chief editor at Amazing Stories, he called him the man who invented flying saucers. Basically, what Palmer had a very interesting view of reality. And I think the line between reality and fantasy was a very malleable one for him. From what I've read, it seems, he was, as a child, he had a terrible accident. He had the very first spine graft in America. And he was told his spine graft would fail, and he describes, and that he would die. He describes mentally healing himself, picturing his spine, and he told his mother that he wasn't going to die and that he would heal himself. And apparently he did, because he didn't die. So, you've got somebody who believes in that sort of thing. For him, reality is possibly not like it is for the rest of us. He also believed dreams inform reality, as well as reality informing dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of people would call Ray Palmer a huckster. And to some extent, he definitely was. he liked to sell a story, for sure. But he was sort of an honest huckster, from my point of view. And because it seems that where you draw the line in reality is, like I said, to him, it was malleable. So when he came upon the flying saucer, first with Chaver, he had the idea of, this sounds crazy, but what if it is true?
Mm.
So essentially he invented that sort of story. It sounds crazy, but what if it's true? And I'll put it out there, and there are going to be people that want to believe it. So basically, the Chaver mystery, to boil it down, Richard Chaver first wrote Ray Palmer, when he was editor at Amazing Stories, a letter saying he discovered an alphabet called Manton. And next to the Latin alphabet, he placed a word next to each letter of the Latin alphabet, saying that if you take any word and take each letter and then replace each letter with the word he put next to it, you don't mean it. So for instance, A, animal, B is BE, to exist, often command, G, generate, H, human. So, you know, take any sentence and just break all those letters down and do that, and you possibly get meaning. So one of the editors got a hold of this letter first and threw it in the trash, and Ray Palmer pulled it out of the trash, and legend goes that he said, you call yourself an editor? And he decided to publish it. So he published it, and he encouraged the readers to try it for themselves. They did. And sure enough, some of them said, yes, I found meaning. So there were believers right there. So Shaver wrote Palmer this sprawling 20,000-word letter. And it told a story, but not very well. It didn't really have a protagonist or a plot per se, but Palmer boiled it down and put all that good stuff in there. And he published Shaver's story as I Remember Lemuria. And essentially what's boiling the Shaver's idea down, it's there was a race on this planet. They found the sun's rays harmful, so many of them left, and those that couldn't leave were forced underground. Underground, they had these, you know, vast tunnels and cities, and there were these devices that if didn't properly shield them, they emitted harmful rays that would cause people around them to degenerate. So one group shielded them, one group didn't. The group that shielded them were called the Taros, and the group that didn't were called the Daros, and they became degenerates. And Daro stands for detrimental robot. In Shaver's world. And in Shaver's world, a robot is somebody that uses thought control, is controlled by thought controlling rays. So they're controlled by these, but they in turn also control us humans up here on Earth with their thought controlling rays. Turns out that most likely Shaver was a paranoid schizophrenic. Palmer claimed that he actually talked to people at Ypsilanti State Hospital, where Shaver was committed for a bit. And he said that this was confirmed. However, Palmer continued to publish Shaver's stories. He would edit them, and Shaver got better and better as a writer, had an outlet for all of his creative energies. He and Palmer actually ended up with a real close friendship that lasted to the end of their days. So Palmer really pretty much saved Shaver's life by giving him this outlet. But in the course of it, they together invented the sort of story that's science fiction that could be true. And many people believe it. And people believe it to this day, that there are strange creatures inside the Earth controlling us here on the surface with their mind control rays. So that's the Shaver mystery. But then when the Flying Saucer mystery came out, Palmer had left amazing stories. And he and Curtis Fuller got together, amazing stories. They wanted to move their offices to a new state, and they didn't want to move. So they started their own magazine called Fate Magazine. And it was a little late out of the starting gate for Kenneth Arnold's sighting on June 24th, 1947. But Palmer did contact Arnold, and Arnold agreed to write a story for Fate Magazine. So he got Kenneth Arnold's story of his sighting in the very first issue of Fate Magazine. But he also, along the way, somebody had written him a letter saying that they had found some interesting material, strange, unusual material, on a beach near Tacoma, Washington, on an island called Maury Island. Palmer said, well, tell me it's from a flying saucer and I'll be interested. Oh, yeah, it's from a flying saucer. So these characters turned out to be Harold Dahl and Fred Chrisman. Now, what's interesting is Chrisman had written Palmer a letter during the Shaver mystery days, saying that he and a friend were fighting in a cave in Burma, and they came upon some Daros, and Chrisman said his friend got a dime-sized hole in his hand from a Daro ray gun. So Christman's already being very inventive, shall we say, creative. And so, yeah, so this story comes up, and it's this thing by Christman. Ray Palmer contacts Arnold because Arnold lives in the area. Arnold, I think, lived in Oregon. And he said, would you be willing to fly to Tacoma, Washington, and look into this? So Arnold did, and Palmer wired him $200, and Arnold became the very first privately funded UFO investigator, or flying saucer investigator back then.
Absolutely, and it's one of those cases that convinces Arnold that he's not up to the job, because this is a real mess, even looking back now at it, Charles, that you look at it and you think, as you've mentioned it, I mean, Christman is a very strange character anyway, because when I was reading the book, there's a section in it where you refer to the fact that he pops up 20 years later in another conspiracy, which might surprise a lot of people, because he's implicated in the JFK assassination.
Jim Garrison was investigating Clay Shaw in New Orleans. He got a letter from an anonymous source saying that this guy, Fred Christman, was the first person that Garrison would turn to if he got into trouble. You should talk to him. So Fred Christman was subpoenaed, and he testified at the Clay Shaw trial. And you can actually find his testimony online. So, the idea that Christman might have written that letter is certainly a plausible one. And, you know, it just seems that Christman liked to insert himself into the middle of the mystery. But to boil the Maury Island incident down for any of your listeners, Harold Dahl and Fred Christman claimed to have been harbor patrolmen. And Dahl said that while he was out on patrol, he saw six donut-shaped craft, one of which seemed to be in trouble. The others circled around it. It dumped a bunch of black hot stuff and then a bunch of white stuff that kind of looked like newspaper. And then they all took off together. The black stuff was hot, hit the water and steamed. Dahl claimed it broke his son's arm and killed his dog. In any case, turns out what they really were they ran a salvage operation, and they would salvage logs that got loose from logging operations when they were floating them in the harbor. And so in any case, when Kenneth Arnold went to investigate, the first thing he was shown was some of the black material. And to him, it looked like a lava rock. And he actually writes about this. Read about this in a book called The Coming of the Saucers. I think it was published in 1952. And Ray Palmer was the editor. So he and co-author. Yeah, there's a detailed account in that book, and has in quotations him saying, "Why, Harold, this is only lava rock." So right there, he's starting to wonder. Christman claims he's got film. He never produces the film. Arnold calls up a friend of his, Captain E.J. Smith, Big Smithy, who had had a sighting himself. And because he thinks that he'll want to, you know, that this could help him corroborate his own sighting, he says, "Hey, do you want to come on board? Give me a hand with this. I think I'm a little, you know, in over my head." He says, "Sure." So he goes to Tacoma. And Smithy becomes interested enough that he cancels some flights. He's a commercial pilot. And so they interview Dahl and Christman. Dahl is extremely reluctant the whole time. Then Dahl and Christman go away, and they get a call from a newspaper man saying, "You know, this guy has been calling me and relating conversations in your hotel room verbatim." So Arnold and Smith freak out. They look for bugs, and they start getting really nervous. Then Arnold feels compelled to call two Army Air Force's Office of Special Intelligence men who had helped him who had looked in on his very first, on his sighting, and took down his information on that. And they had offered, you know, if he ever needed any help or ever saw anything again, you know, give him a call. So he did. And they were willing to come out to Tacoma to take a look-see. So their name was Brown and Davidson, were their last names. So they weren't impressed and went to leave. It was very late. Arnold and Smithy tried to convince them to stay, but the Army Air Forces had just become the Air Force, and there was a celebration for that going on the next day, and they had to be back for that. So they said they took off very late at night, and just before they left, Chrisman said, you know, well, can I give you some of the material to take with you so you can analyze it and investigate it? And they're like, yeah. He drove home and he put a bunch of this stuff in a cornflakes box. And as they were getting into their car, he pulls up in his car and they transfer the cornflakes box in their car and then drive off to the plane. Well, unfortunately, the plane caught on fire. Brown and Davidson managed to evacuate everybody in the plane but themselves, and they went down and died. Chrisman apparently called the local newspaper and gave them Brown and Davidson's name and said that they were carrying material from a flying saucer when their plane went down. And you will know the story is true because the Army hasn't released their Army Air Forces hasn't released their names, and when you get their names, you'll know I'm telling you the truth. And sure enough, the next day, the Army Air Forces released the names, and the article showed up in the papers. So with that, Arnold skedaddled. they called one more guy, a colonel, I think it was a colonel, and the colonel heard their story and then drove them out onto Maury Island and showed them some piles of slag that he said, you know, this is pretty likely, looks kind of like what you saw, right? And they're like, yeah, I think so. So, yeah, they both took off, and Arnold, on Arnold's way back, which funny is in the book, says he stopped for, he made a fuel stop, and then when he took off again, his plane conked out, and he made a really hard landing and bent one of his wheels. And he said when he went to look at his fuel line, he saw the petcock was closed, and in the book he writes, and I was the only one who could have done it. So that's kind of hinting at the Shaver mystery and mind control, and you kind of get this, you can see Ray Palmer kind of heavy hand on that Arnold story right there. But what I did in the book is I took this, you know, Arnold's narrative, and that, you know, I use that as the main narrative, and then I compare it. There are extensive FBI files on this case with interviews with all the key witnesses. Because of the plane crash, the FBI was looking for criminal culpability.
Sure.
And Dahl and Chrisman just say, yeah, it's a hoax. We made it up. And yeah, nothing to see here. And later they recanted and said that, we were under duress. But there's also a reporter who was interviewed, a freelance reporter who had gone to interview Harold Dahl, and he reported that Harold Dahl's wife was furious and enraged and demanded that Harold Dahl come clean and confess that it was all a hoax, and he said Dahl did so. I saw somewhere, I forget where, so I couldn't put it in the book, but I saw somewhere that she was actually brandishing a knife. the reporter, yeah, the reporter ran scurrying and tried to get a hold of Arnold and said, you know, he wasn't able to get through. So, you know, I compare this, the narrative in The Coming of the Saucers to the FBI file, and also the story in Fate magazine is written by Arnold. which was much closer to the event. And there, you know, there are definite discrepancies there, and most of them are likely due to Ray Palmer's heavy hand.
Yeah, and certainly some artistic license has been used.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact
that
in the FBI statement that the reporter gives that you've mentioned there, who has the misfortune of bumping into Dahl and his wife, says that he quickly left in view of the enraged condition of Dahl's wife.
yeah.
And that Dahl was a mental case.
Yep.
And I think it's one of those, you can already see the germination of some of the belief that often infects certain cases, Charles, that there seems to be this real willingness to believe until it sort of comes to Arnold and Smith's realization that they're being hoaxed here. They're having their legs pulled, but these two guys are clearly up to something. And when you look at everything and the statements that were given to the FBI after the plane explosion, clearly it seems that Chrisman was a very enticing person in regards to the fact that Dahl seems to have been the patsy for this, the sort of straight man, and Chrisman was sort of pulling all the strings behind the scenes, and somebody was clearly leaking things to the press and other papers and other journalists. So it's very obvious that, for me, there's some kind of Malkovichian planning going on here, where someone is really pulling the strings and trying to get as many people to accept their version of reality once again here, even in this very early case.
Yeah. Well, and there are believers in this case to this day. They still celebrate it out in Tacoma. And, you know, this is just one of those cases that will not die. And I don't think, you know, it's like the Aztec case, too. That has so many holes in it. You know, the main witnesses were caught, convicted swindlers. And yet, you know, the Aztec case lives on. That being said, there are a lot of cases out there that are really intriguing.
It is surprising for me when you mentioned, obviously, the Aztec case is one. The one that made me raise my eyebrows is this mention of 1955 with Carl Allen and Morris K. Jessup, because the whole Philadelphia experiment, I think it's one of those, once again, like you've just said about the Aztec case and the Tacoma case. This has been with us now nearly 70 years. And it's clearly, when you look at everything and the whole story, this is what became the Philadelphia experiment. And it's remarkable for me to look at this case and the flimsiness of it, and the fact that the person who claimed to be involved in it 15 years after they went to Jessup to speak about this, said, no, it's all nonsense. I just made it all up.
Yeah. And Bill Moore, you know, William Moore wrote the book, The Philadelphia Experiment. It's been debunked yet again, you know, conclusively. And yeah, it's another one. It just will not die because, you know, it's a really good yarn and people like to believe it. So, you know, I can see holes in the, you know, I can see, like, for instance, the Flatwoods Monster. There's a reasonable argument that they saw an owl, the owl hissed, and they freaked out and ran away. I personally love the story, and I prefer to believe it, you know, so.
Me too. It's one of my favorites. It certainly is. I think the other thing in regards to Allen as well, I think the whole Philadelphia experiment seems to be one of those that we often see in ufology as well, Charles, that these stories seem to disappear for a bit. And then somebody sort of comes along and the Philadelphia experiment, obviously, as you refer to the book, giving it legs, but also Art Bielik, who went on Art Bell several times claiming to be the main person. He'd suddenly taken the story on, hadn't he? And that, I remember listening to him talk about that on an interview with Art Bell. And people are pointing out that his birth certificate doesn't match up with his version of the story because he would have been too young. He wouldn't have been in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
So he claims, obviously, this is a cover-up by the U.S. Navy. And people went, oh, fair enough.
Yeah. You know, I just realized, because I'm getting ready to, I'm working on the UFO investigators, which a little cover from post-Blue Book up until William Moore's speech at the 1989 MUFON Symposium, where he basically said, we've all been had by disinformation agents. I played a part in the game.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember seeing that interview. It is available online, and he's being heckled, and people are trying to get on the stage to get him and all sorts.
What's interesting, too, is I think he's part, to me, it seems part of that heckling is that, you know, he's pooping on some of their favorite stories more than the fact that he was a disinformation agent. But in any case, an interesting thing occurred to me is that during that period, cases from long ago, such as Roswell, for instance, and the Philadelphia experiment and Maury Island, it's like these investigators, these just ancient cases that investigators got their teeth into and wouldn't let go, played the predominant role in ufology during the 80s and 90s.
Mm.
Especially Roswell, with that just wouldn't go away. And it's such an old story, you know, and meanwhile, there's still stuff going on that everybody's ignoring.
I've often found that surprising. To be honest, Charles, that's one of the reasons I became so disenfranchised with ufology about 20 years ago, because it just kept being the same old handful of stories over and over and over again. And when you're looking at your book and reading some of the articles and the first-hand report came out at the time, you can kind of see that in some of these cases, there is the modern version, which is a tale of a tale of a tale of a tale, or there's the actual report and the people involved in it. And like you said, like when we were mentioning Aztec there, the main proponents of that were convicted fraudsters. They were people who, weren't they sort of implicated in the fraud, and ended up selling some fake shares to pay their bond.
What happened? Yeah. it's Silas P. Newton and Leo Gebauer. Silas P. Newton was the main spinner of this yarn. Basically that a 99 foot diameter flying saucer crashed on a mesa in New Mexico, in Aztec, New Mexico. And every measurement in this thing was divisible by 9. Significance. I think there were supposedly 16 bodies inside, dressed in the period of the 1890s with brass buttons. Skin was chocolate brown, and some of the skin was chocolate brown, like it'd been charred, possibly due to exposure to our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
The story was written by Frank Scully, who wrote for Variety magazine, and he knew Newton. And the story, Newton had, was a mystery speaker in Denver, Colorado, at a school out there, and it was the University of Denver, and he spoke on flying saucers. It was for students who were working on critical thinking in their studies at the time, and he told a story of 3 crashed flying saucers in America and 1 in Africa, and then the hunt was on for this mystery speaker was, and then the name Silas P. Newton came out, and it turned out that Scully knew Newton, so Scully got in touch with him and got the story that there's also a scout craft and that this Dr. G, as Scully describes it in his book, Behind the Flying Saucers, published in 1950, just after the very first book by Donald Keough, Flying Saucers Are Real, was published. Scully was close on his heels. So Frank Scully wrote Behind the Flying Saucers, where he tells this story. And in the story, he describes that they bombed the craft with Geiger counters, cosmic rays, and other protective devices until it was considered safe to attempt to enter the craft. The way they entered the craft is there was a hole. They poked a stick through the hole and found a button and pushed the button, and the door magically opened. So in any case, an investigative reporter, J.P. Kahn, looked into the story for True Magazine, and he published an article called The Flying Saucers and the Mysterious Little Men in the September 1952 issue.
Mm.
So He started, he had his doubts about Newton. Newton presented himself as a real big wheel in the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
And he got this flying saucer stuff from his friend, who we called Dr. G. When Kahn looked into it, he claimed to have rediscovered the Rangeley oil field, which was run at the time by a subsidiary of Standard Oil. So Kahn went out there and started asking around about Newton. And he found out that Newton ran what was called a doodlebug operation, where you have a device that you claim can find oil, and then you sell your basically worthless oil leases to prospective to suckers. And after the book came out, Newton's twist on the story was that he had a device that had technology from a flying saucer that could detect magnetic waves coming from oil. And oil does not emit magnetic waves, for those of you who are wondering. But anyway, yeah, so the story came out, and then Kahn started wondering about people who had been swindled. And he put out the word, and then people came forward, and he found one guy had been taken for $300,000. Okay, we're talking 1949, 1950 money, so that's a lot. And this guy was willing to prosecute. And he also just found out that the mysterious Dr. D was most likely this guy, Leo Gebauer. And Leo Gebauer and Silas B. Newton were the guys running the scam. So, yeah, they were brought to trial in Denver. They were found guilty, convicted, and told to pay restitution. And first thing Newton did was go out and sell $18,000 of worthless uranium stock to help pay back his other suckers. And so, you know, yeah, this is the key proponent of this this flying saucer story. And it continues to be debated today.
It's remarkable when you look at some of these characters and these hoaxes that they were quite happy to take advantage of people. I think, once again, when you have situations like this, as with anything throughout history, where people have a belief, whether it's in spiritual natures, or if you look at sort of some of the things that went off in the spiritualism boom in the sort of late 19th century, Charles, there's a lot of comparable characters that seem to arrive. I remember reading about a pair of brothers who claimed to be in contact with the spirits, who did a roaring trade, but would only perform inside a box in the dark. And when you look at it now, you think, what on earth were people thinking? And yet here we have a guy who's a convicted fraudster telling people, well, I've got this special machine using UFO technology that allows me to find oil. Come with me. Give me your money. And you hear these stories. It's throughout history, there are always these people who claim to be able to lead people to riches or the knowledge. And I always remember one of the funny stories about Mount Shasta was this guy that claimed to have found a city full of gold and jewels underneath it, and he just needed some money to build a party together. So he gave him some money and he arranged it all. They all turned up, and the only person that wasn't there was the chap who'd organized it, who disappeared with the money. But people want to believe it. I mean, even in this day and age, we still see people, and we laugh about some of the emails people get about, you know, being promised millions of pounds from certain accounts from foreign countries, and people still send them their bank details, Charles.
Yeah, well, there's another couple of flying saucer hoaxers, hucksters that I didn't talk about were Reinhold Schmidt. I think he was convicted of convincing this lady that he had crystals from another planet that would heal people. I'm not sure, but he was definitely convicted of fraud for something sort of like that. There's Otis T. Carr, who claimed to be inventing a flying saucer. And Otis T. Carr got investors and promised demonstrations. The Long John Nebel, who had a big talk radio show, which was the first paranormal talk radio show ever. In the 1950s, he went live with Otis T. Carr, and Otis T. Carr never quite delivered. there's this strange device with some gears and motors, but it wasn't anti-gravity as he promised. Yeah, so these guys are definitely torn up all around the flying saucer biz.
I mean, when you look at some of these people who were around and in sort of inserting themselves into this whole flap that seemed to really kick off in the late 40s, Charles, it's very interesting. The more I read about a lot of the other characters, the less dismissive I am of George Adamski. Now, I'm not saying that George Adamski was having visitations with aliens and they were sending their messages to him, but I think when you look at some of the other people who were clearly out to make as much money as they possibly could and were taking advantage of people's gullibility, people's belief, somebody like Adamski seems like quite a, I suppose the term would be a useful idiot, because he was simply preaching about a better way of life and these messages that he was receiving. And obviously, yeah, a lot of people, but people once again believed him. But in comparison to some of these other characters, he seems quite naive more than anything.
And he did produce books. At least he had a product. Yeah. you paid to hear him speak, whether you believe him or not. That's your business. Yeah. But at least he wasn't taking people for millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars. But yeah, it's interesting that the contactees got the FBI and the CIA interested, because a lot of what they preached was, give up your atomic bombs and learn to live in peace. And a lot of people were saying, well, that sure sounds like communist propaganda to me. Give up the bombs. The commies would love that, wouldn't they?
Yes. So I suppose when you look at it in that context as well, people like Adamski were quite brave, because as you refer to, I know we're joking about it, but it was clearly why the FBI and the CIA were really interested in these people, because they thought that they'd been sort of tapped up by Russian agents and they were being sold this lie to kind of spread this message of universal peace, weren't they?
Yeah. They definitely looked into they kept a close watch on UFO organizations, not only for communist infiltration, but also looking for leaks, but actually, interestingly, is Coral Lorenzen was a staunch anti-communist. Coral Lorenzen started the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization in 1952. That was a formidable, powerful organization. They had such a good global network and they got so many good cases. And unfortunately, the only real reference place you can look at, get an idea of what they were doing and get any kind of inkling of what their investigations entailed, was through the APRO Bulletin, which they put out extremely regularly all the way up until 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a rumor that the APRO files might become available at some point. And that's as far as I'll go with that. But but on the other side, you've got the National Investigations Committee on it. Well, I mentioned APRO because, Coral Lorenzen was a staunch anti-communist. And actually, people in the early days had to give her a signed statement that they weren't communists before they were allowed to be members of her organization. So she had herself covered from the get-go. Formidable organization, just because they had a really great network, a global network. And, this is before the internet. So this is all mail and phone calls. They really had a lot of people in South America. One guy, Dr. Olivo Fontes. He's the one that clued them into the Antonio Villas bullet.
Yes. What a case that is.
alien sex fiend.
Absolutely.
Actually, a great goth band from back in the day, Alien Sex Fiend.
They were indeed.
but uh, And so, and that was too hot for them to actually publish in the Apropos, and they didn't publish until much, much later. They found that a really controversial case. But they got that because of their contacts in South America. If you read the Apro Bulletin, you'll see cases from Sweden, you'll see cases from England, just all over the place. And from Victoria UFO Research Society in Australia, I think they got the William Gill case.
Yep.
Yeah, so they had a great network and international. NICAP, the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena, had a real good national network. They had a series of what they called subcommittees in just about every state, maybe every state. I don't know. I've never seen a listing of everything. But in any case, yeah, if something happened in somebody's backyard, there was a central place to report the information. NICAP, they kept extensive files, and those files are housed in David Marler's archives. David Marler is the steward of the NICAP archives, as well as the QFOS archives, Center for UFO Studies. And they're extensive and wonderful to look through. I've been to his place, I think, three times. And, that's like one of the most valuable things the investigators did, was keep those records. So you can just go through them and find stuff. And there are cases in there that have been forgotten that are pretty mind blowing, make you wonder, why isn't this a classic case? And I find that constantly when I'm writing. One thing I'll do is go through the UFO News Clipping Service. Those are available on, Archives for the Unexplained. So they start in 1969 and go all the way up until 2008, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go through them, it's like month by month, and all of a sudden there'll be a story. Oh, that looks cool. Okay, I think I'll write about that. And I'll try and see if any investigators are mentioned, and then oftentimes I'll be able to actually go back to the original investigation files and find it. And right now, there are still investigators out there keeping the archives, but they're a lot more scattered, and you've got MUFON, but they're a little, they keep their files a little close to the vest, but at least they're keeping them.
Yeah.
There are still investigators keeping the files. And I think the files, just the written files, are really invaluable, and just in terms of preserving the history of all this.
Well, I think David's very similar to yourself, Charles, that it's the cases that when you look at it or you read about them, as you refer to there, you think, well, why don't more people know about this particular case? This case is too good to have been lost. And it's the same here in the UK, that people tend to focus on three or four particularly well-known cases where it seems people have simply pored over it and pored over it. And you think, well, how much more can we find out about this case? And then somebody else appears after 40 years of history to give their version of it. And you're like, well, it's been in the media for 40 years. It's not hard to come into a couple of specific cases that we have here in the UK, Charles, with a knowledge of it and sort of insert yourself. Rendlesham is a prime example of perhaps the most notable, referring to what we were saying about Dahl and Chrisman earlier, about someone inserting themselves into a case who wasn't there, essentially. And then eventually things spin out of control. And it's interesting for me that regardless of which country you're in, it's probably the same in Canada. Canada, people will talk about Falcon Lake or Shag Harbour, or even occasionally they might mention the Guardian case, primarily because it was on Unsolved Mysteries, I think, more than anything. But you can't tell me that there aren't hundreds of cases that are probably better than those, and we've, for some reason, they've just never hit the headlines.
Yeah, you find them in local newspapers. There's some really great cases in Canada that I've written about in local newspapers. But and also, I love Flying Saucer Review. That was a wonderful magazine. When Gordon Creighton was that's a British publication that Gordon Creighton put out. And yeah, like you said, there are really amazing cases in there. And yeah, it's just, you know, one or two cases will grab the headlines. Somebody becomes a UFO personality. That's a big thing too. If you've got just a couple of key personalities who were everybody's paying attention to, they control the narrative. And, you know, that's where everybody's attention goes, is where they point. Meantime, you know, you've got a little Joe Nobody over here who's investigated a really cool case out in the wilds of Northern England. And, we'll get to you later.
The chapter that really made me chuckle a lot was the French Hairy Dwarves chapter, which is Charles 7 in the book, because I love these kind of cases, because I remember once reading something where someone who clearly, it was like one of those memes you see online, Charles, tell me you don't know anything about UFOs without telling me you don't know anything about UFOs. And they were just basically saying that all UFO cases had happened in the States, and therefore it must be some kind of mass delusion or medication. And I just thought, how can you know so little about a subject and make a sweeping statement like that? Because people often say, oh, well, nobody reports UFOs in Europe. And I was thinking, you know, even if you take the UK out of it, there are hundreds of cases.
Belgian UFO wave. That was a big one.
Yeah. You had the mystery rockets in Scandinavia. You've got, I mean, the triangle thing. People say, oh, well, nobody else saw. There were reports in Holland and Germany at the same time.
There were also mystery airships over in Australia. There was a French wave of humanoid reports in 1954.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of those as well, because it's one of those stories where you meet this non-assuming gentleman and his dog. And there's a lot of these stories. Once again, as we mentioned about Flatwoods, he'd got this wonderful dog, I think, who was called Kiki, which is a brilliant name for a dog, that alerts him that something strange is going on. And because of where he is and what happens, he thinks they're smugglers at first, because it's a well-known smuggler's track that he comes across these weird creatures wearing sort of diving helmets.
Exactly. And what's really cool about that story, Patrick Gross, I got the information from Patrick Gross's site, and what he does is he just has newspaper article after newspaper article after newspaper article. And the main the witness in this, his name was Marius DeWilde, and DeWilde said that a blinding light came out, and he said he was paralyzed by fear. And then as you go through the newspaper articles, paralyzed by fear eventually morphs into him being paralyzed by the beam of light. And then afterwards, you get cases of people saying that they were paralyzed by beams of light. So that was really interesting. But you know, actually, what's not in the book was that they found really deep indentations in railroad tracks.
Yes,
where this craft had supposedly landed, that they said, you know, it had to, whatever was there had to be really heavy to made them.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those as well. These are tantalizing things that we don't often get in a lot of well-known cases, that You'd got some physical evidence of something happening, and the key witness was absolutely cast iron in their belief of encountering something peculiar.
And this is where Jacques Vallée got his start doing all this. The main go to guy at the time, the flying saucer expert, is M.A. Michel, because Michel had just written a book. Therefore, a French researcher who had just written a book on UFOs. Therefore, he was the UFO expert. So he was the person the press went to. But a young Jacques Vallée, who had his own sighting of a classic disc with a bubble dome on top, he contacted Michel and praised him for his scientific approach. I think Valet might have been all of like 19 years old at the time. He was just a young pup. And they began a relationship from there. And of course, we all know what happened to Valet. He's become, you know, one of the elder statesmen. He's still around today.
Absolutely. And still writing and still investigating.
Yeah. What's funny is, yeah, there were just sightings. There were all these sightings throughout 1954. But what's really funny is that there's a law on the books that was passed in 1954 in the town of Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
Yeah.
Prohibited flying saucers flying over, landing, or taking off in community territory. Article 2 states, any aircraft known as flying saucer or flying cigar, which should land on the territory of the community, will be immediately held in custody. And Article 3 places that responsibility on the forest officer and city policeman. So I wrote, that's quite a responsibility for a small town gendarme. But that law is still on the books.
Oh, brilliant.
At least last I checked, which was a couple of years ago.
Well, it's probably is the reason why we don't get many modern reports from France then. Clearly, they've taken that on board, Charles.
Or at least Chateauneuf-du-Pape. I'm sure they've got all kinds of flying saucer occupants in the Ouzgal over there, and saucers are impounded.
There is a tantalizing sentence in that particular chapter as well, which says, obviously, Nexus magazine covered this strange.
Nexus was Jim Moseley's magazine.
Yeah.
Jim Moseley went on to, he and his former International Flying Saucer Bureau members, that was Albert K. Bender's group, he got together with a couple of them. They formed Saucers. They came up with the name Saucers first, and then figured out how the words to fit the acronym afterwards. And they came up with Saucers and Unexplained Celestial Events Research Society. The first magazine they put out was Nexus. And then Saucers remained until Moseley's death, sometimes with him as the only member, in 2012. So it's arguably the longest-lived organization ever, private organization. And yeah, it started off as Nexus, and then eventually it became Saucer News. He sold it to Gray Barker, and then eventually put out Saucer Smear, and he put out Saucer Smear until his death. So Nexus was the first magazine of Jim Moseley's.
It's this, obviously following on from this strange encounter in France, they ended up covering a couple of other stories from the same area, which also involved dogs, where they claimed that one of the witnesses said that these spacemen, whoever they were, or saucermen as they call them, took time to pet the witness's dog. I love these weird little anecdotes that we get in some of these strange cases from the 50s, where I think that there are reports of spacemen being frightened by dogs. You've got these petting the dog, and then obviously you've got Kiki the dog in the original report. So,
you know, dogs do play a big part in ufology. I actually saw a really cool story about a mother dog. There was a flying saucer emitting the light that's coming into the house, and a mother took her pups and hid them behind a curtain.
Wow.
Picked them all up by the scruff of the neck, according to the witness, and just hid them behind the curtain. But to give you some insight into Moseley, he juxtaposed the story of the spaceman petting the witness's dog with other spacemen being scared by the witness's dog and jumping back into their saucer and taking off. And he commented, this leaves us here at Nexus headquarters in a state of confusion as to whether spacemen like dogs or not. Apparently some do, some don't.
Well, this is often the thing with these reports, especially of that era. You seem to get contradictions, which I suppose feeds into this belief, or this concept that people consider that if we are being visited, we are not being visited by the same sorts of aliens or UFOs, Charles. We are getting visitors from from different systems, different planets, who clearly, some of them have a preference for pets and some don't.
Yeah, you know, different strokes for different folk. it's a cultural thing, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think Venus, they're is dog friendly. There a dog, a large space dog named Bo,
what was his name?
One of the contactees, Buck Nelson.
Oh, yes.
Space dog from Bo. I think that was from Venus.
Oh, yeah.
And he would sell bags of Bo's dog hair at his flying saucer conventions.
Yeah.
Hair from a genuine space dog.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you've just awoken some latent memory in my mind. Oh, how can you forget? I mean, that just, you know, it's one of those. I mean, if we're talking about crazy things, there's one case particularly I want to touch on before I let you leave, if that's all right, Charles. And this
absolutely
is one of my favorite cases from this whole era, and it's Joe Simon.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the first time I heard this story, it made me laugh, primarily because it's so out there. There's all kinds of bits to this story that make you think, is he really just pulling everybody's legs? But I think everybody that spoke to Joe found him a deeply sincere witness.
Yeah. And well, for me, and what makes the story really interesting was the way it was investigated. And what happened to Donald Kehoe in the course of this?
Yes.
So a big divide between APRO and NICAP was that Donald Kehoe and NICAP would not touch humanoid reports. They had no problem with flying saucers, but they didn't want to deal with whoever might have been driving them. Because that was way too close to the contactees. And Kehoe just hated contactees. If he considered you a contactee, he would revoke your membership and publicly shame you in the UFO investigator. But APRO, they were all open to the humanoids. They loved the humanoids. As long as they didn't talk.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah, this case comes up. This guy, Joe Simonton, he said, he was a 54-year-old plumber, handyman, and part-time chicken farmer. And he said that on April 18th, 1961, a flying saucer classic landed in his driveway. He went out to go see, a door opened, and he saw a humanoid standing there. The humanoid made a drinking motion and handed him a vessel, and Simonton realized that he wanted water. So Simonton went, filled it up, brought it back, and the being was thankful. He gave a sort of salute by touching his fingers to his forehead, and Simonton gave him a military salute. Then he saw two other humanoids. One seemed to be tethered to a control panel, and one seemed to be tethered to a stove and seemed to be cooking flapjacks. The creature who wanted the water saw Simonton looking at this and handed Simonton four pancakes. The creatures were described as basically humanoids, swarthy like Italians. Simonton gets the pancakes, the door closes, the saucer takes off. It shot off, and the backwash caused the tree to bend over and then spring back and wiggle back and forth like in a cartoon. Simonton is left there with these pancakes, according to him. So he went to his friend, Judge Franklin Carter. Franklin Carter was a NICAP member, and he ran a saucer club. He held meetings at his house. And according to him, Simonton hadn't attended any meetings, but he did come to a public forum where Carter had given a presentation titled Battle for the Moon. But anyway, because Carter was known as the local flying saucer expert, Simonton went to him with his story. He told him his story. Carter asked if he could have one of the pancakes for analysis. Simonton gave him one. Carter sent a piece to Donald Kehoe along with a letter. The story got into made the paper, and Carter was interviewed, and Carter promptly told reporters that Kehoe and NICAP were analyzing a pancake from outer space. He did this without any confirmation that from NICAP that they were willing to do so. In the meantime, NICAP is really busy working on this extensive book called UFO Evidence, a book containing over 700 cases, I think culled from 3,000. And they're working to get it into the hands of every member of Congress, lobbying for UFO hearings, really trying to get the Air Force in to, answer for their sins. So they're very hard at work with that. And for them to be dealing with a space pancake at that point was just ridiculous. So they didn't want to deal with it. Well, what happened in the meantime, over at Project Blue Book, the Air Force's UFO investigation, it was being headed up by Colonel Robert Friend. Robert Friend was a former Tuskegee Airman. J. Allen Hynek, who was a scientific consultant for Project Blue Book, the most prominent, and he was an astronomer. And Friend called J. Allen Hynek and said, you should get down to Eagle River, Wisconsin, where this had all taken place, and talk to this Simonton guy, because I think NICAP's going to make a big deal of it, and we don't want them accusing us of ignoring the case. So Hynek says, yes, sir, and Hynek goes down, and Hynek found, he brought a couple of his graduate students from Northwest University down to help him out. And he found Simonton very credible. He also asked around town, started up conversations at a bar, at a restaurant where he was eating with Simonton. He excused himself, went to the bar, and worked his way into a conversation about Simonton. Everybody was like, oh, no, he's a great guy. Yeah, if he said he saw it, he saw it. And so, as far as Hynek could tell, Simonton seemed to be telling the truth as he knew it. Hynek also felt there's an old Roman saying, one witness equals no witness. So he advised the Air Force, this guy sounds on the up and up, but, I really don't suggest you go too far with this case. It's only a single witness. Mm. In the meantime, NICAP is getting hammered by their membership saying, why won't you look into this case? And they were always experiencing financial difficulties, and now they were their membership was criticizing them, and they were actually losing members over this. So Richard Hall wrote a letter to somebody who eventually got us. NICAP actually was moved to get somebody to analyze the pancake. And that guy was Lex Mebane, who was one of the original members of Civilian Saucer Investigators New York. And he wrote to Mebane saying, accordingly, this contactee case couldn't have happened at a worse time. And so Blue Book comes out smelling fine, and NICAP comes up smelling not so well. And actually what's really funny is Hynek had this analyzed by the Food and Drug Administration, and it was also analyzed independently by a local Air Force investigator at the Aeronautical Systems Division of the Air Force. Mm. And they both found low protein, flour, sugar, and salt cooked in hydrogenated oil. So essentially buckwheat pancakes. So yeah, that's the Simonton case.
Yeah. I think wasn't the official Blue Book conclusion that Simonton had suffered hallucination followed with delusion?
It's one of the few, it's very rare that they ever comment on a witness's mental condition. Yeah, they said the conclusion on the Project Blue Book record card for the report is that Simonton suffered an hallucination followed with delusion.
Well, it makes a change from swamp gas, I suppose.
Yes, it does.
Oh, well, Charles, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's an absolutely brilliant book full of crazy characters, strange situations, cases that really deserve more recognition, Simonton especially, regardless of the origin of these space pancakes. Where can everybody follow your work and your regular column and get hold of a copy of this brilliant book?
Oh, they can go to podcastufo.com, where I have a regular written blog every week. Usually comes out Monday. Also, an audio blog posted on Martin Willis's YouTube site, Podcast UFO YouTube site. And the book can be found at Amazon.com. And I believe at flyingdiscpress.com. Yeah, so that's that.
Fantastic. I know you mentioned it earlier, and I know it's obviously very tempting. So clearly, there's hopefully going to be a sequel to this book, as you refer to, for the period, because obviously this book runs up till 1969 and the closure of Project Blue Book, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm working on the sequel. I'm writing blogs about the period, trying to get my toe in. It's a very difficult period to write about because the ufology just really goes off the rails in the 1980s. I love the 70s. The 70s are just wonderful. They have really great stories like the Pascagoula incident.
Yes.
And there's, other really wonderful cases throughout the 70s. But then in the 80s, it's just, that's when the UFO personalities start to take over. And people with either real credentials or made up, credentials, both military and academic, start coming forward saying, making outrageous claims with absolutely no evidence to back it up, yet saying, I'm a 5-star, I was a 4-star colonel or colonels don't get stars, but whatever, I was a very high ranking colonel with a top security clearance, and so everything I say, you should just take at face value. And so there was a rash of that going on. And so it's a very difficult period to write about, but I'm getting in there, and I'm going to give it my best shot.
Fabulous. Well, if this book is anything to go by, I can't wait for the second volume. So once again, Charles, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure, and hopefully we'll speak again in the future.
You too, Paul. You have a great night.